Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And on this week's show, yes, we are taking a look at the great DDoSing of 2016. We will be having a look at the attacks against DIN or DIN or however you want to say it. And we will be asking the question, what now? You know, what now? Now there are a zillion perma-owned things out there in the wild that are able to launch attacks that can take down some, pretty serious web properties. IoT device security specialist Stephen Ridley will join us in this week's feature slot to discuss that. This week's sponsor interview is a certified cracker. We will be chatting with Cylance Chief Research Officer John Miller about how the hell you're supposed to benchmark AV these days. It is actually trickier than you think, for reasons we will go into later. We also talk about managing false positives and hit on a few other topics in that one. John is ex-ISS X-Force, so he's been around the traps for a long time and he really knows what he's talking about. That is a great interview and it's coming up later on. Big thanks to Cylance for sponsoring this week's show. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, holy shitballs, what a week.
Oh yeah, well the internet's had a really rough time actually while I was away from the keyboard for a week. I guess that's tradition for Risky Biz holidays. But
I didn't think of that. It's maybe the curse is contagious.
maybe I have caught the Patrick Gray holiday disease. Yes, no, the internet took a thorough hammering last week between denial of service and some sweet bugs and all sorts of good stuff going on.
Yeah, well barely had Haroon and I finished talking about how Mirai is probably going to be a bit of a problem. Yeah, someone decided to prove that one, right?
Yeah, a massive distributed denial of service attack against this company called DIN, which is a hosted DNS provider, started off. And yeah, it was in the, up into the terabit range all up. But really massive DDoS and took out, as a result of them providing DNS services for a bunch of people, took out a bunch of relatively high profile web properties, you know, Twitter, Reddit, Spotify, some people like that. Yeah, and it turns out actually that this company, DIN, which I hadn't particularly heard of, one of their researchers actually has been working with Brian Krebs on figuring out a bunch of the research into people who are doing DDoSes and DDoS for hire services. He presented a talk at NANOG a couple of hours before this thing kicked off, hitting DIN and taking out people all across the internet. So yes, looks like Krebs and his work is a continuing target for the underground, and they're taking it out on all sorts of people.
You mean it wasn't WikiLeaks supporters?
Well, it's funny actually because I think one of the groups, sort of nominally associated with this DDoS, made some wisecrack about WikiLeaks and them being WikiLeaks supporters on Twitter. And yeah, that appears to have been taken beyond the comedy troll that it was, up into and apparently including WikiLeaks on Twitter themselves asking their quote supporters to stop, unquote.
Yes, turn the internet back on, people. We know you are doing this for us. But it's pretty funny because you've seen people saying it's Russia, it's state backed, it's whatever. And it's just kids who hate Krebs, man. That's it.
It is. And it's turned into such a big fallout across the internet and then mainstream reporting about the internet because people want to tie it into all the rest of the geopolitics going on. And whilst there is plenty of geopolitics going on, it's not this kind of massive DDoS. This is just punk kids getting all salty because Krebs is, doxing their booter services or their stressor services or whatever. And yeah, it's, script kiddying writ large.
Yes, it is. And what's hilarious about this is you've got everyone running around like headless chickens wondering what to do. So you've got the government's, the US government's Senate Cybersecurity Caucus. They're hitting up federal agencies asking for solutions. You've got speculation that maybe the FBI should go and just, turn these things off in some sort of, bot neutering operation. You've got people suggesting maybe vigilante action is correct. I mean, just no one knows what to do. You've got one of the IoT device makers recalling their products. No one knows what to do with this one. And, I've spoken to some people in DDoS mitigation. They say, and you ask them, can you deal with this one? And they're like, sort of. Do you know what I mean? And keep in mind, we've heard, I think it was Sophos said that this only involved 100,000 devices. So this is like 10% of the total Mirai zombie bot army. Like, that's not much.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, obviously, internet speeds are up. There are a lot of devices everywhere. IPv6 is making them yet more directly reachable. You know, this is never going to get smaller than it is now. It's only going to get worse and bigger. And, yeah, obviously, the DDoS mitigation firms are one of the few people who've got something actually useful to do here. Go buy some more pipe, perhaps. But, yeah, everybody else is just kind of thrashing about. And I mean, the talk about, you know, the FBI bricking the devices remotely is obviously ridiculous.
Well, hang on. Why is that obvious? Ridiculous. I mean, if it gets to the point, say this continues, right? You keep finding some nice weak points and hitting them, man. If they're able to take down DIN with 100,000 devices, you know, there's like millions of those things out there. This could turn into a problem where you could not be assured of internet service to some extremely major properties, and then it might make sense.
Well, I think that, you know, that's a
maybe
that's
not bricking them, but logging into them and maybe shutting down Telnet, you know, cleaning them up.
Yeah. I mean, I see the appeal for it, and I think if it's going to happen, you'll see some vigilante group do it long before the FBI and else gets through the red tape of actually deciding that they're allowed to do it. But it's a trick you get to kind of use once, because, you know, you do it once, and then the next time round, the botnet will, you know, shut down the telnet service or change the passwords or whatever infection mechanism it has. Before, you know, once it's gained entry, so that you can't do that. Mirai actually does have some code to shut down the telnet so that you can't do that. It doesn't work very well, which is part of the problem here. But that's not a sustainable course of action, right? It's just going to make the bots evolve, and we'll see this arms race continue without that option available. So I don't know that that's a thing that's really worth expending all of the hand-wringing that would go with doing that. The idea that ISPs could cut off the pipes to consumers, like that's got more legs because it's a more useful thing that you can do long term rather than attacking.
But I mean, would you want to wear the help desk support costs of that?
Well,
Like that's going to cost. That would cost a fortune to implement.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And that's the core problem there, is that there is no money in being a residential ISP, and it would cost them loads of money in handling the support calls in the process. So no, that's not an option because there's no money in it for anybody, which really doesn't leave you with very much except, you know, go buy some stock in Prolexic or whoever.
You know, and one thing that I think has been sort of forgotten in all of this is it was only a few years ago that someone, you know, Party Unknown, actually owned up about 400,000 IoT devices to do the internet survey. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I have the data on a bunch of disks just off the side of my desk, actually. It was a fun piece of research. It wasn't me. I didn't do it.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because at that point, it didn't ring any alarm bells. No one invested in additional infrastructure. You know, people actually, it wasn't enough to prove the concept. Someone actually had to go out there and do something harmful.
Well, that's how it goes, unfortunately. People just have no interest in doing what they have to secure the devices that they've bought until there is a real cost to them, like their internet being turned off. Or the vendors, you know, actually start baking security options into the setup and making these more robust. And that's not going to happen until there's consumer demand for security as a thing that makes you better in the marketplace. So,
or regulation. Yeah, but either way, the refresh cycle on an IP camera is quite long. But we're gonna get into that with Stephen Ridley later on in this week's feature interview. But look, let's move on. Otherwise, we're going to be here all day talking about this one. Hey, now, here's a story that actually should have made it into last week's show. I had seen it, but then when I drew up the news list, I just missed it. But I'm glad we can talk about it today. This is about a side channel attack against CPUs to bypass ASLR, which looks like when you read this, you just think, Adam's going to like this one.
Oh, yeah, no, it is. It's great research. I had a quick rummage through the paper because obviously, you know, academic security research can be kind of rubbish, but this is an example of the sort of stuff that academic research really does a great job of. So this is a side-channel attack using the branch predictor cache on modern CPUs to kind of, you know, figure out where figure out the offset being used by ASLR randomization. The demonstration actually is attacking user land and kernel space ASLR on Linux, but is equally applicable on other platforms. Yeah. And basically involves kind of setting up a pair of processes, or one process and the kernel, and then like filling in your instructions such that they get picked up by the branch predictor in the CPU, which is responsible for kind of trying to optimize branch instructions as the CPU is executing them. And then by measuring the timing of your process executing, figuring out whether or not your branch was in the right place to correspond to another process. And this works because Intel architecture has, like the branch predictor cache doesn't use the whole like the whole, well, you can kind of use virtual memory to map your branch into the same location as the one you're trying to determine the location of. And then by time measuring that through timing, you can figure out whether or not your guess about the layout of memory in another process, or the kernel in this case, is correct.
Is it practical? Is it practical, this
well,
this
yeah, that's what's really cool about this. Their demo apparently lets them figure out what the KSL, the kernel space ASLR kind of randomization offset is in something like 60 milliseconds. Which is super practical. I mean, obviously, the caveat here is this is for the case where the attacker is running on the same CPU as the process that he's trying to attack. So not for remote attacks, only for kind of local local exploits or privilege escalation, that kind of thing. Or on virtualized hardware, where you might be able to do this across the hypervisor boundary. That could be kind of interesting.
As sort of attacking something remotely that's on the same metal, you mean? In a different
VM. So, if you can buy access via Amazon to the same physical hardware and then use that to attack a process running another VM, that would be real cool. They haven't demonstrated that, but that would be the obvious kind of next step to make this more useful than just the local. But yeah, great research, well worth reading if you're into this kind of low-level architecture stuff.
Now we're going to stay with ridiculously complicated exploitation techniques and talk about Rowhammer on Android. And look, Rowhammer has just been one of those things that has been delightful to observe growing and changing, and more people are doing work on it. A group of researchers has figured out a new way to sort of weaponize Rowhammer against Android devices, and they've actually built an app that Android users can go download, which will test their phone to see whether or not their phone is susceptible to this technique, and then, you know, sort of share the results with these researchers. So they're trying to get a really accurate idea of what percentage and what models of Android handsets out there are actually vulnerable to this. But this is looking increasingly like a really viable attack technique.
Yeah, this is great work, you know, moving Rowhammer across onto the ARM architecture, making it available to run on Android. And yeah, like turning into an app that people could just download and test their phones with, that's real cool. Their demos appear to work, you know, a reasonable portion of the time on both Android 5 and 6 era OSs across a variety of hardware, though of course it does vary a bit. Apparently depending on things as sort of strange as the age of hardware or how much it's been used, you know, sort of how worn out the RAM cells are. But yeah, it's seeing this attack sort of, you know, germinate from a relatively impractical sounding thing to actually, yeah, we can use this to actually, this totally works in the wild. It's fun to watch, and it'd be interesting to see what their stats are once they've got a whole bunch of people trying this app out.
Staying with Android, and I'm sure many of the listeners would have seen news of the so-called dirty... Oh, no, we're not doing that. We're not doing name vulns. That's right.
Oh, that's right. We're not. No,
yep,
name vulns.
That was a decision. There's a Linux kernel bug, which has been named and is doing the rounds, and apparently it applies to Android. It looks like a pretty serious one, this one.
Yeah, this is quite a cool bug, actually. One of those ones that's really simple in both its exploitation and in the mechanism by which it works, and yet super effective and goes back a long, long way. This is the bug in the copy on write functionality of the kernel, where you can kind of overwrite a memory page through racing some particular kernel operation through copy on write. Kernel local privilege escalation on Linuxes from early 2.6 through to basically the present day, which is everything, including Android devices and lots of embedded systems and servers and all sorts of good stuff. This bug has been doing the rounds, and there are exploit code for it in the wild. Presumably everybody's patched, because it did get a lot of media coverage, even though it had a silly name. But it's a good bug. Good bug.
Pwn to Own has been and gone at PAXSEC in Japan, and a Chinese team over there just cleaned up.
Yep, the Keen team have been through and owned all the Android devices, they owned the iOS devices. Apparently they popped iOS devices that were running, 10.1. Whatever it is, 2, that got dropped a few days ago. They have working exploits against that. So yeah, they cleaned up, made some fat, a couple hundred thousand US dollars worth of cash. So really good work. Good work by them. There were some other attempts, I believe, by MWR and a few other people as well. But yeah, lots of good money being dropped on some very fancy looking bugs.
Yeah, well, Apple did just drop iOS 10.1, which was patched a pretty bad bug, man. It's the sort of thing you're not used to seeing in iOS, but it was a JPEG parsing flaw that was like immediate remote jailbreak root everything disaster. That's a bad one. Lucky it seems like it wasn't in the wild. It was just quietly patched and then somebody noticed.
Yeah, no, that is definitely a sort of bug that we haven't traditionally seen so much of on iOS and Mac OS X as well. Apparently, it affected that. But yeah, sort of in the vein of stage fright there, which is not what we look for from Apple.
It's worse, man. JPEG. It's like the libpng. I think was it a libpng bug a while ago? Oh, that one didn't pan out. But yeah, no, image decoding bugs bad because they're real easy to trigger, man. Like get someone to view an image through any piece of software on their device.
Yeah, that's not exactly a difficult bar to meet.
And it's not just Linux having trouble, kernel bug trouble. Bit of a bun fight has been revealed between the Project Zero team and Apple.
Yeah, so it was one of the Project Zero researchers came up with what actually is a really sweet kind of bug, or even though sort of almost like a bug class, I guess, against the Apple kernel that's shared across OS X and iOS, reported it off to Apple with the usual Project Zero disclosure timeline. And then Apple, wanted to spend a little bit of time to fix this particular bug because it is quite a juicy one and one that they – it's almost kind of architectural in the kernel rather than being just an easy thing for them to fix. They asked for a bit more time to fix it. Project Zero said no because they do their 90-day disclosure timeline, 60-day disclosure timeline. And there was a bit of back and forth, and the Project Zero bug tracker reveals this in the disclosure timeline that eventually this culminated in Apple's senior leadership contacts Google's senior leadership to request that Project Zero delay the disclosure, which then resulted in the subsequent disclosure and the until after the release of the most recent macOS patch. But yeah, a little bit of a kerfuffle there, and I guess on one hand it does kind of draw some light on. Exactly how realistic some of these disclosure timelines are. But also, I guess it's kind of good in a way that senior leadership are being drawn into discussions about security as a thing that they have to care about. So that's good.
I think that security when it comes to an operating system manufacturer is something that senior leadership do take seriously because they have to. I think we're there. And you were right the first time. It is a 90-day window. I think they were requesting an additional 60 days. But for a patch like this that touches the kernel in about a million different places, can you imagine the regression testing Apple would have had to have done before they shipped this? Can you imagine the effort involved?
Yeah, I certainly got a lot of sympathy for how much work it must be to triage a bug like this. And, especially when it's a bug that is likely to be repeated in a bunch of other areas and you have to kind of go through and fix the whole class of flaw rather than just one particular one. And then, as you say, the amount of regression testing across the variety of devices. I mean, we know how much work, Microsoft and Apple and the other big OS vendors, well, I guess they are the only OS vendors, put into the kind of testing that they have to do. And yeah, obviously having the same stringent requirements for how fast you have to fix a bug for, someone like Apple or Microsoft fixing it in core OS kernel versus, some rubbish third-party vendor that's just, making antivirus software that runs, on three boxes like Trend Micro or whatever. not to pick anyone that Project Zero have wailed on lately, but yeah, it's not the same thing to have to fix something as
complicated. No, it's not. And that leads us to the question, is a 90-day window from reporting to patching something that's an incredibly, as you said, it's almost an entire bug class in an operating system that's all over the world with thousands of different applications running on it, is saying you've got 90 days or screw you, we're going to drop O-Day on you. Is that reasonable? Because I can understand that, just in a normal enterprise app or whatever, or even a consumer app, sure, that is reasonable. But when it comes to something this complicated, I mean, can you imagine the type of restructuring Apple would need to do in the way that it engineers its operating system in order for them to be able to patch things like this in 90 days? Because that would be a gargantuan effort. And you'd think if they're going to spend that type of money and that type of effort to do something positive for the security of their boxes, you'd think you would probably spend the money elsewhere. Right?
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with you, right? I think that is not a reasonable thing to necessarily expect. And I think what we're looking at here is, a relatively extreme case where it is a complicated bug in a very, very widely used product. And I mean, I think the point of the Project Zero guidelines here really is to have a lever to push vendors so that they don't think they're being picked on, that it's, equally applied to everybody. And I mean, that's it's a tool to try and improve the overall security of the industry. And I think by and large, this kind of full, timed full disclosure, responsible, whatever we're calling it these days, overall is a net positive. There are just some cases where it isn't reasonable on a case-by-case basis.
It's always been, it's case-by-case, exactly. It's always been my issue with these sorts of rules, is because rules are great, but there's always the "it depends." And I think, you know, in InfoSec, people can sometimes have a tendency to ignore the "it depends" and just go, no, this is a rule, we're sticking with the rule. And I don't know, it just, look, end of the day, there's a whole bug class that's been eradicated from OS X. That's great. It's a positive for users. It is a positive for Apple. But I just don't know whether or not it's a great thing that it went down this way. I just don't see that it needed to. But end of the day, I mean, it's not the end of the world, right?
No. I mean, you know, overall, we're still in a better place than we were. And I think, you know, these kinds of sticks are important where the vendors are jerks. You know, if you're dealing with, you know, with an IBM or an Oracle or, you know, someone who really isn't responsive, these sticks are important. And we've evolved these sticks because we have to have them to force those vendors to respect their customers and do the right thing. Whereas, you know, Apple and Microsoft and I guess even Adobe these days, right, kind of understand that they do have to do these things. And, you know, maybe we can cut them a bit of slack now that they are mature.
Yeah, well, I just don't think 90 days for something like that is feasible. And, you know, I used to have a much harder line. And it's funny because I've spoken to a few people about this and they're like, no, screw them. They should just get it patched and they should make it a priority. I'm like, they do. And I got a lot more sympathy for organizations in Apple's shoes, mostly because I knew a bunch of people who worked at Microsoft when they had to really get things better organized, you know, so that they could do better patching, faster patching. But like, if you look at what's involved in the regression testing, just the regression testing on something like this, it is mind blowing. Do you know what I mean? Like 90 days, you're just not going to get it done without really changing things and investing a crazy amount of money into it. Do you know what I mean? Like it would seem a strange way to spend your time and effort to actually be able to do something like this in 90 days.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it is in not all cases a reasonable thing. But, you know, you have to have extreme positions to kind of move the center point around. And I think that's what this is.
Well, and I think that's kind of what they intend, Project Zero. I think that's the way they think about Project Zero.
Very sensible people. Some of them are very good friends of mine. So
yes, and indeed mine too. And, you know, we might criticize you every now and then, but we love you guys. You know it. And we respect you. We do.
Yeah, and you guys do amazing work, so f***ing A, Project Zero.
Oh, and there's been a wonderful old Senate inquiry here in Australia relating to the failure of our online census. What's been most satisfying for me watching all of this unfold and some of the subsequent reporting is that it looks like my early coverage was actually correct.
Yes.
Back in August, right? Which is always nervous when you're the only journalist who's saying, hey, this is what went down, and like no one is corroborating it. It can give you a couple of sleepless nights, but now we know, yes, in fact, IBM screwed it up. We know that, yes, according to Next Gen Networks, they did offer DDoS protection that IBM said, nah, she'll be right, mate. We'll just drop outside. And how's this? Like they're saying, oh, we'll just drop outside connections. Even though their password reset like needed overseas access, and some Australian ISPs actually route through overseas. And yeah, like the whole thing was as bad as I had written up. And in fact, maybe a little bit worse here and there. And of course, you know, as a service provider, NextGen's like, yeah, okay, we can maybe do some geo-blocking for you. But, you know, this is way above and beyond what they'd give to a normal customer who hasn't opted for DDoS mitigation. So yeah, basically, long story short, IBM has come out of this looking really awful.
They really did come out of this looking awful. I mean, A, the idea that geo-blocking is a reasonable thing to deploy to mitigate against DDoS is just demonstrates such a fundamental misunderstanding of how the network works that really does not fill you with any confidence about their ability to deliver anything. And, of course, the fact that it then went tits up kind of underlines that. And then, of course, there was the thing with their router not being reboot-proof. The Twitterverse has made a lot of hay of that, you know, reposting
GIFs from the IT crowd. But that was the thing that I posted about how they hadn't synced their secondary, right?
Yes.
That's why it's saying a reboot would have saved it because they reconfigured it, but they didn't restart it. So when they dropped their primary, the secondary just wasn't there.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's the thing. Like every little detail that I managed to get a hold on, like they all checked out. So I'm just like, ding, 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 trifecta. Yeah. It's been fun, man. Quickly, the Russia-linked phishing campaign behind the DNC breach has also been linked to the Podesta and Colin Powell hacks. That's no surprise there. Something interesting that has happened, though, is, you know, we saw this story from NBC saying the CIA had drawn up plans to strike back at Russia and blah, 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 blah. Well, funnily enough, Surkov, who is Vladimir Putin's right-hand man, Mr. Destabilized Perception himself, he's had his email spool dumped. Oops.
Yeah, apparently hackers who are Ukrainian-aligned broke into his mail spool, have dumped a whole bunch of emails from him and a bunch of other personal docs.
Ukraine-aligned hackers? You mean like Gucci for 3.0?
Yeah. Apparently they are called the Cyber Junta in whatever the equivalent is in Russian that I don't want to try and pronounce. But yeah, they dropped like a whole bunch of his emails. And apparently some of the analysis of this email does say that it's probably legitimate because the emails are also very boring, which is, you know, that's, I guess, a good metric to judge political leaks. But yeah, there's like copies of his passports and all this kind of thing. And then there's a bit of, you know, there's been a bit of sort of, I guess, hyperbole, like calling this the beginning of, what do they call it, mutually assured doxing.
Yeah, I like that, man. That's good terminology. One thing that's funny, right, you know, people in the Democratic camp have said, well, we don't know that these emails, these Podesta emails and whatever are legitimate. The funny thing is they've been signed by DKIM, so you can verify them. So,
crypto,
you know, like,
beautiful thing.
It is. And it's just funny when you realize, oh, shit, we use DKIM, you know, trying to do the right thing. And I remember a few years ago, someone was tweeting, I think it was like Solar Designer or someone was tweeting that, you know, you want to use short keys and rotate them for exactly this reason, so that you've you know, so that you can actually deny stuff when it's leaked. Funnily enough, though, Vladislav Surkov's email, you know, this is Putin's right-hand man, his email not popping up on WikiLeaks. That's funny.
Interesting. Maybe that's just because Julian's got no tubes at the moment.
Oh, man. Just quickly, MedSec has filed a defense in its lawsuit, the lawsuit St. Jude Medical filed against them for defamation. They have filed their defense, and contained within their defense was a report from Bishop Fox, which appears to support their findings that there were a whole bunch of critical, awful bugs in St. Jude's devices.
Yeah, I guess don't think there's any surprises there. I'm interested to actually see some of those Bishop Fox findings and stuff, because it does sound like they've got a pretty good team on it, and they have done quite a thorough smacking of it.
Yeah. Yahoo, meanwhile, has asked the Director of National Intelligence in the United States to declassify the order that asked them to scan mail. I think, you know, we can sort of assume that Yahoo is of the opinion that if people saw the order and how specific it is, that people's minds would be, you know, people would sleep better at night. That's my feeling.
Yeah, well, I guess they want to be able to say, hey, look, somebody made us do this. It's not our fault. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. You know, don't whinge at us. And that's a, you know, I guess I would understand that position if I was them.
I don't think it's even just that. I think, you know, there's people out there thinking that they had a list of keywords, you know what I mean, that they were scanning for or something. I think they want to show that it was very targeted. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, hopefully they will actually release it. We will get to see what the specifics were, or at least kind of the wording around that order.
A Russian hacker arrested in Prague has been indicted by the US on owning up Dropbox, LinkedIn, a couple others, I think, FormSpring. Yeah, so Evgeny Alexandrovich Nikolin. So bad luck to you, guy. It looks like you're going to get a little involuntary holiday. And yeah, Adobe has patched a Flash 0 day that is being exploited in the wild. That's like a, it's a pretty regular headline.
Every day.
It's nearly dead. Give it another year and a half, I reckon it's gone.
And good riddance, about time.
All right, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. You know, our news list overfloweth this week.
Yeah, it's been good to kind of catch up on all the things that was going on while I was away and seeing the internet burn down. I should probably go patch some things now.
All right, mate. Well, good luck with that, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boyer-Low there. And don't forget, Adam works for Insomnia Security in Wellington in New Zealand. They have offices in Auckland as well. So if you have pen tests, app reviews, red teams, or consulting stuff you need done, do check them out. I know a lot of the people who work there personally, and they are indisputably an extremely high-quality crew. I think they're launching some interesting services too later this year that we might actually have to do a feature on, because it is genuinely interesting and cool and new stuff. Anyway, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Stephen Ridley. Stephen is a security researcher turned entrepreneur. He is the founder of Senrio, a company that specializes in IoT monitoring gear for enterprises. And it's funny too, because, you know, it's a little startup that's just picking up steam, and then this happens. So yay, Stephen, beer's on you. But yeah, unless you have been living in a cave recently, you would know that the attack against DNS provider DIN got underway just under a week ago, knocking several high-profile properties offline. Think Spotify, Twitter, I think even Netflix had some drama, and Amazon as well. Now, of course, the first question that came to mind for me was, why are people using primaries and secondaries with a single provider? You know, that just seemed like a weird DNS resilience strategy to me. I mean, secondaries are there for a reason. You know, that said, I guess in this complicated world, when you're managing a zillion subdomains, using an outsourced provider might make sense, you know, but if you set up a slave secondary somewhere else. But anyway, I'm getting off track. DIN was DDoSed by the Mirai botnet. Back on topic, Pat. Back on topic. And yeah. And the funny thing is, yeah, I mean, as you heard in the news, Sophos estimated it was only like 10% of the Mirai botnet that was actually involved in the DIN attack. And from what I've read, the attack wasn't even particularly intelligent in how it rolled. I mean, there was like GRE traffic and whatnot. So yeah, there we have it, folks. 10% of a poorly weaponized botnet made out of toasters and security cameras managed to knock a whole bunch of huge internet properties offline. 2016 is amazing. So, you know, now, of course, there's an ongoing turf war as various bot herders try to consolidate their zombie armies. And it is just a matter of time before people figure out how to better weaponize these compromised devices for maximum carnage. Anti-DDoS providers say they can sort of kind of mitigate this thing, but even they admit that this is a pretty legit problem. So what do we do? How do we fix this? As you heard in the news, people are kind of freaking out. Should the FBI get involved? Vigilantes, recalls. Stephen Ridley joins me now. And mate, what do we do? Because I am lost on this one.
I think everyone is to some extent. I think the big problem right now is this paradigm shift that's kind of happening where people are realizing security guys kind of have this approach, but I think enterprise is starting to realize it, and definitely guys in like industrial control. And that is that you basically have to assume that the endpoints and the devices are already pre-compromised and plan accordingly. So if you accept that as fact, it really changes your entire workflow. It changes the way you architect solutions. It changes the way you build networks and that kind of thing. So I think there's more focus kind of shifting to monitoring. I think a lot of the guys who do behavioral stuff are definitely excited about this because it really makes their point really well, which is that, you know, you have no guarantee that the walled garden approach no longer works.
Let me ask you something, because it's my understanding that a lot of these devices, they've been compromised because they have hard-coded passwords in their firmware over command line interfaces that the users or the owners of these devices probably don't even know is there. Now,
right.
If I understand it correctly, you can't even change those passwords without giving those devices new firmware. Is that right? So what they've been doing, like they've been taking over these devices and then like disabling Telnet to lock other people out. But is that right? Are these things actually firmware encoded passwords that cannot be changed without a reflash?
Yeah. So if we look at it a couple different ways, there's two kinds of like the hard coded credentials, actually three kinds of hard coded credentials. They're the ones that are intended to be easy for a user to quickly start using the system. So they're printed in the setup manuals and that kind of thing. So those are intended to be user passwords. And usually, maybe sometimes the recommendation is that you should change them. So you have that problem. And then you have the other problem, which is backdoor user credentials, right? Which are the ones that the manufacturer doesn't necessarily notify the user about, but that are hard-coded into the devices. And we see those kinds of credentials a lot more than we see the, a poorly configured user credential stuff.
Because it seems like, you know, with the user credentials, like every time I've bought like a edge device that's just some consumer edge device, it hasn't had any ports open to the outside world, right? You're logging into it on the other side of NAT. So I just don't understand, like, what are these devices and who makes them? Because we're talking digital cameras and DVRs and stuff like that, right? Why are they even on the internet? How does that work?
That's a great question. So in those cases, when you're talking about those edge devices, the reason why those tend to be, and I'm using this in quotes, safer is because those devices tend to be multi-homed, right? You have a concept of a WAN and a LAN. But the problem is with webcams, with DVRs, basically any other embedded device, is that if they are multi-homed, it's only like Wi-Fi and Ethernet, and most of them are just single-homed, so they only have one interface. So all the services, everything, run on that one interface. So there's no concept of public and private. Anything that's exposed to the network is exposed to if it's placed on the public
internet. Okay, but why aren't they behind NAT? Like, what the hell?
So they can be NATed, and so that's where you get into, you know, a lot of people, that's their usual response. Oh, well, we have a firewall. There's no way you can reach it. But what we've seen from some of the even consumer-level devices, we actually have a blog post on our website about a home IoT controller, And the way that their firmware actually worked was to tunnel back into the manufacturer's infrastructure. So you can actually, if you compromise your own device, in this case they had hard-coded encryption keys, SSH keys, if you access yours, you can access all the other devices on the net through the manufacturer's backend. So you get stuff like that where people are saying, well, the defense is that it's NATed and it's behind a, you know, it's behind a firewall, but then the devices sometimes just subvert that anyway using tunnels and whatnot.
Yeah, okay, so they're going back to the manufacturer, but how am I going to then get in the middle of that and take over that device? Are you saying that once I've got the edge device, I can man in the middle of those callbacks?
Well, so it's different for each device, but the one use case that we talked about on our blog was for this one particular device, it uses a SSH port forward to basically make it so that any your internal network at home, and again, this was kind of an IoT hub, so all your IoT devices were accessible on your NATed home network through the manufacturer's backend. So you could basically tunnel your web connection through their website
okay.
and into your home network. You see?
Yeah, okay, I'm with you now. So you just go right yeah. through the manufacturer to take over the device.
Yeah, and in this case, the same SSH keys that they used to set up your individual box were actually in the mask ROM. In the chips, and they were embedded in every device like it in the world.
Well, the good news there is that the manufacturers would be in a position to fix those devices. But again, you need to reflash them, don't you? You need to actually reflash the devices. This isn't a case of just change password. It's like new firmware.
Yeah, and that gets to that third category of stuff I was talking about. You know, you had the first one, which is default user credentials. Then you have the second one, which is user credentials that the user never knows about that are kind of backdoor passwords. And then you have the third credentials, which is embedded encryption keys. And those last two, the user credentials that users never know about and the hard-coded encryption keys, are the ones that we see in maybe 90% of the devices we look at. And so that is really where the problem is. And in many cases, those encryption keys in several devices we've looked at recently, for example, those are embedded in the mask ROM, which means it's literally read-only memory, so it's not even flashable.
Right. Well, that's great news. Thanks, Stephen. Cheers. So the question becomes, though, man, like, what do we do about this? Do you know what I mean? Because we got all of these IoT things, right? Like, how can we even fix this? And the thing, I just don't see a way. We're just going to have to wait for these things to end of life, man. We're going to have to wait for people to rip them out and replace them and hope the next ones are better. So I'm wondering, what are the refresh cycles on these types of things? Like a video camera? I can't see that you would have a particularly short refresh cycle on that. It's not like an Android phone that's bouncing around in your pocket with your keys for 2 years and eventually gets screwed, right? So you replace it and the battery doesn't work anymore. It's not like that. Yeah. These things are going to sit there for like, what, 5, 10 years?
Yeah. So I think so. Gartner and Forrester and some of the other analyst groups, they have really good like high resolution metrics on this stuff. But what we've seen is, like you said, cameras. You're looking at 5 to 10 years. Also, they're not super patchable, right? Like, because patching usually involves like plugging in a flash drive or direct connecting the through a crossover cable or Ethernet cable into a PC to update the firmware. Usually over-the-air firmware updates for embedded devices are not trivial. Let's put it that way.
Expecting many of the owners of these cameras to go get a ladder and a bit of Cat 5 and some firmware and spend their weekends fixing them up. I don't see that happening.
So it's not even just that, but also if from an enterprise standpoint, there's an operational cost to doing these updates because a guy literally has to do what you said, not just once, but probably hundreds of times at every site. Right. So there's just a cost to it and they don't want to incur that cost. It's just easier just to take the risk.
So brass tacks, like Mirai is a evergreen botnet, man. It's not going anywhere.
It's not. And then, I said 5 to 10 years for things like cameras, maybe, but we're seeing 10 to 15 to maybe 20 years on industrial control devices. Right.
But are they being owned as part of this Mirai thing? Because I hadn't heard that.
They're not part of this Mirai thing, but I will tell you it's coming because the same vulnerabilities we see on embedded devices in the consumer space, we're seeing equal, if not worse, vulnerabilities in the industrial control space.
Well, this is a really cheery chat, and I'm gonna turn up the joy just another couple of notches because one thing that occurred to me recently is the reason this isn't worse is because a lot of these things are NATed, right? They're sitting on NATed environments. It's funny what you said, too, about the port forwarding because it made me remember the bug in Synology NAS And the reason that was such a disaster is because they operate a dynamic DNS service for their customers so that they can go into like username.synology.com. And that's how those devices were getting popped. And I didn't know, but I've got a Synology. And the only reason I found that out is after the talk of the bug, I'm like, that's weird. I never enabled that. Then I got the latest firmware and it's like, hey, put in your awesome subdomain name. And I'm like, no, just no. Yeah. Okay. That's a bad idea. I like NAT. Yep. NAT stops bad things from happening. The problem is IPv6 is coming, right? And IPv6 is routable everywhere. There's no real such thing as NAT. You know, there's firewalling, but not really NAT. And by the time people figure out that they have to kind of firewall their IPv6 devices, like that's 15 years before people realize that they have to do that. So do you see many things being built now that actually have an IPv6 stack already? Because that would be somewhat terrifying.
No, so some of them are, but I'd say that like the really critical, highly monetized systems are not. So a lot of the, you know, the industrial control space, most of the embedded devices that service industry, those things are just catching up to
V4, regular. Right? Yeah. But what about all of the shitty little PVRs and cameras and home routers and stuff?
Yeah, so that stuff is probably going to happen sooner than the industrial space. But honestly, you know, and I like this point, you've been making it a couple times on your podcast, which is that this is only the beginning and that, you know, these attacks, you know, it's going to start off as DDoSes. It's going to start off as kind of really simple things, but we're quickly going to get into how to monetize these things, right?
Yeah.
How to actually exploit these systems to have real impact in the real world. And it's not a huge leap to go from a DDoS of a web service, which is kind of a lame thing to do, honestly, with such a huge network.
To malware distribution. Woo, ding, ding, ding. Am I right?
Yeah, malware distribution, or hey, let's upset critical infrastructure, right? Yeah. Like that is that's a completely different ballgame. And I feel like we're just right on the cusp of it starting to happen.
So, I mean, we're already seeing like DHS going, oh crap. You know, a few government bodies in the United States having an oh crap moment, which is, you know, it's a little bit late for that. But what should the response to this be? Because I can't imagine there's any sort of quick response. You might want to reach out to the providers who are doing things like, you know, access forwarding through their services, and you might be able to mop up, say, 10-15% of the bots that way. You might want to sort of figure out a way to black hole some of these things, those usual sort of responses. But, you know, more and more of these things are coming online every day, right? So this is not, it's not going to be a quick fix. So the question becomes, what should the response of government be? Because you've got everyone saying, we need to regulate this. You've got a lot of people, sorry, not everyone. A lot of people saying we need to regulate this, force them to adhere to certain standards. And then you've got other people saying, no, it's a market problem. It'll sort itself out. Where do you sit on all of that?
You know, I think it's going to be multifaceted, like you mentioned. So I think there's going to be obviously like Federal Trade Commission, SEC, they've been kind of hinting that they're moving towards this. There's some people in industry that also are calling for a little more regulation around these devices. But, you know, we've been kind of thinking about it here at the office at Synreo, and the manufacturer of the devices that were affected by the Mirai botnet, you know, they did a recall. They just announced that recently. And so
which manufacturer was it? Because there's a bunch of manufacturers in the mix.
I think it's, I don't know how to pronounce it, Xiaomi or whatever.
Okay.
Xiaomi.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know how to actually pronounce it. But one of the major manufacturers, the one that comprised the majority of that Mirai botnet, they did a manufacturer recall on the devices, which is strange because it's not necessarily a defect; it's just a problem, right? It's a misconfiguration, and we were wondering why they might have done a recall. And so what we suspect is happening is that recalls, in this case, this was a legal decision.
Yeah, it's a liability thing, right? Hey, we recalled it because no one's actually going to rip them out and actually send them back, right?
Exactly. So it's, you know, very much like bankruptcy. So it's like a designation that basically allows them to absolve themselves of responsibility. And so I think we might see more things like that happening where business will take note that, oh, you know, these are the consequences of mass compromise, right?
Mm.
And then realizing that they need to adopt either internal security controls or, you know, try to beef up some of the security of the individual devices, like that might be a forcing function along with the other things that'll happen, like the legislation, and then even enterprises are just going to get fed up at this stuff happening. They don't want to expose themselves to the risk.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, obviously on the enterprise side, that's where you guys come in. There's your little plug for you, Stephen. If anyone's interested in actually being able to control some of the risk that comes from IoT devices on their network, Senrio, Stephen's company, makes some cool stuff there. So do go check them out. So I guess, you know, one other aspect to this is I'm imagining that, you know, people who make networking equipment are going to do nicely out of this, because all of your Akamai's, your Amazon's, your Google's, all of these companies, Cloudflare, whatever, they're going to have to invest in some upgrades, aren't they? And they're going to pass that cost on to customers. So we are looking at a bit of an economic effect from this thing, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I think if you don't mind just going back to what your question about what do we do next, I think a big thing is going to be that manufacturers of these devices are also going to be looking for solutions that they can embed in firmware. So that's going to be another big thing.
Well,
so
last time you were on the show, we were talking about this, about how we're going to have to move to some sort of standardized IoT operating system so that things like this aren't a problem. We had that conversation like a month or two ago, you know, and here we are.
You know what? And that's definitely going to be obvious. That's the obvious place that the solution, that's the obvious place we're going. But I think that's like at least 5 to 10 years out. In the meantime, because the problem with that is that even if one manufacturer, like even if someone great like Google comes along and makes the equivalent of Android for
things,
embedded devices,
even
if that happens in 5 to 10 years, that's great. But there's still going to be the Siemens and the Schneider Electrics of the world who have invested decades in building their own custom stacks. There's still going to be companies like VxWorks and these guys who make real-time operating systems. So at the enterprise, in the industry, there's still going to be a diverse environment. So maybe 20% of your fleet is using this new fancy embedded operating system that's secure, but that doesn't give you full coverage. Mm. So there's got to be some other solution. And I think what manufacturers are going to look at is probably kind of middleware things to embed in firmware to make things more secure. I think they're already doing that for the transport layer. They're looking to people for things like MQTT and messaging and stuff like that. So maybe what happens is that security gets bolted onto that stuff as well. And we'll start to see that start to show up in these devices before we get a secure OS.
Well, Stephen Ridley, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us here on Risky Business. And I got to say, I did think of you when all of this kicked off, because I'm like, here's this guy who's running a Internet of Things security startup that, you know, wasn't getting really that much attention, right? Like, and all of a sudden it's like, hey, party on your mega yacht. Am I right? Oh.
not quite yet. We're still, it definitely does help our messaging a little bit, because we were having to explain the problems.
You think?
Yeah, I mean, even as early as June, it's funny, if maybe this is interesting to you and your listeners too, but as early as June, we did our analyst briefings for our launch, our company launch. And a lot of the questions we were getting from analysts and journalists were, can you give me an example of why this is a problem? And you know, we didn't really have public examples we could point to. We only had private, like, consulting and services experience that we could say, look, these are the kind of vulnerabilities we find in these really highly monetized devices. But they were looking for headlines.
Yeah.
And now they finally have one. And
well,
so
I've got
I think
some.
That's – yeah, and now this conversation is going to start to change. We're even seeing people like VCs and stuff are calling around and asking who's doing this kind of stuff. And
yeah.
Can they, you know, it's really getting a lot of attention, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, I do look forward to aforementioned mega yacht party. Stephen Ridley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
That was Stephen Ridley of Senrio there. Do go check them out if you're interested in, getting a handle on the IoT devices in your enterprise, because, you know, they make stuff that does that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with John Miller of Silence. As you likely know, Silence is a relatively new AV company, which in and of itself is kind of interesting. What is also interesting is that Silence is a so-called unicorn. It hit $1 billion valuation some time ago, and they are growing at a rate of knots. And they're gobbling up market share from incumbent AV companies with a big old spoon. Delicious. As a result of Silence's success, as you'd expect. The incumbent AV companies kind of attack them any way they can. Now, look, these guys are a sponsor. They do pay to do these interviews on the show. But honestly, their tech is worth looking at. And, you know, you'll hear incumbent AV companies throwing shade at these guys because, you know, they do. They have some false positives. But then you look at what these false positives mean operationally, and it's really not a problem. And this interview was kind of inspired by a criticism directed at Silence by another AV company. One of the incumbents commissioned some, you know, so-called independent testing, where they ran stuff like notepad.exe through a series of packers and then, you know, scanned them with different AV engines. And of course, Silence flagged it as suspicious. You know, aha, said the incumbent. See, false positive. And yeah, I see that when you take a legitimate file and make it look dodgy as Silence is going to flag it. I don't necessarily see the problem with that. I also see absolutely ridiculous AV testing results from organizations that shall remain nameless. But, you know, there's all these AV tests out there that give really crappy software 100% scores. So, yeah, John Miller is Silence's chief research officer, and he joined me via Skype to talk about AV testing, false positives, and marketing shenanigans in the AV industry. I started off by asking him if they've actually thought of a decent way to test AV yet, because current methodologies seem a little bit lacking, at least to me. Here's what he said.
I mean, so we haven't figured out how yet, to be completely honest. Our big drive is pushing customers to actually test it, right? Like, take it, deploy it in your enterprise. You're already running AV, right? See what we find that your AV is missing. But yeah, I mean, there are some core issues there, right? So the first being, essentially, if you're going to test something with malware, you have to plug into a stream of malware somewhere to get files to test, right? And essentially, what those streams are you know, sites like VirusTotal or WildList or Wildfire or whatever. They're aggregations where they've already used, you know, multiple AV engines to detect that, you know, the files are malicious, right? Or that at least meet some form of signature that's already been created. And so you end up with these weird not only did they attack us for, you know, detecting a modified calc, they also got 100% efficacy. Right. And that's one of the things that you can essentially see on all of these industry tests are, you know, these traditional legacy signature systems getting 100% efficacy over and over and over again. And I mean, that alone means that your test is gained. Right. Mm. If an AV product can get 100% of malware that you test out of it, we wouldn't be having malware issues anymore. So essentially what you're thrown into doing is taking already known pieces of malware, right, that AVs already understand and do well at, and mutating them, right? Either packing them, you know, appending code to them, doing some level of obfuscation to, I mean, essentially for the most part, just alter the MD5 sum of that file. Because that's it. Like, if you have a new cryptographic hash, like, most AV just falls down.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is kind of hard to benchmark endpoint security software that works differently against each other, because you do need, what you would essentially need is a nice big database full of
unknown malware,
right? And that doesn't exist.
I mean, unknown malware exists, but finding it and then putting it together, yeah, it's, I mean, there's no place you can do it, because what people use to tell if something's malware today is VirusTotal.
Hmm.
Right? Upload the file to VirusTotal and then let, you know, 50 some odd AV engines tell you if that file's good or bad.
You know, I mean, one of the favorite things that I've learned over the years is that there are some AV products out there that automatically upload suspicious attachments to VirusTotal. So, and half the time they're legit, right? So you've got all these commercial and confidence documents and binaries flying around that you can just pluck out of VirusTotal. It's good times. That's how Tavis Ormandy got a hold of Bromium. So he could do some testing on it.
You can get a hold of practically anything. And so the fun thing is the number one offender of that I'm aware of is Carbon Black, right? Carbon Black doesn't actually have its own engine. So it'll upload the file to VirusTotal. And we found some interesting things when we've gone through and mined VT specifically around jar files, right? So compiled Java, where, you know, large companies have jars that have things like baked in credentials, and they're internal on developers' machines, and then their security product then takes their jar file, uploads it to VT, you then decompile it back directly to source, and now you have all of their credentials where the company had no idea that they even lost that data, right? Like, it didn't leak through a normal path. It was actually their security product that did it.
Yeah, so no, I know. Yeah, I don't think it's a great feature. Let's put it that way. To automatically upload arbitrary, like, commercial documentation into a cloud service that anyone can access. But yeah, I did think it was somewhat odd that you guys were getting a hard time for identifying, you know, a legitimate binary that had been made to look illegitimate. Like, classifying that as a false positive seemed to be unfair, right? Because there's no possible reason you would need to do that to notepad.exe or calc.exe, yeah, right? There's no reason to do that. So obviously it's not a legitimate thing. Whether that test is fair or not, there seems to be a perception among some people that false positives might be, you know, an issue with silence, or maybe, you know, more of an issue than it would be for things like Symantec or, you know, McAfee or the legacy providers. Is that perception fair? Do you wind up with more false positives than the others?
We do. We absolutely. And it has to do with the fact that AV companies are, they work off of a system of known bad, right? Unless they've seen the file before and written a signature for it or thrown the hash into a blacklist, they automatically assume that a file's good because they're not actually doing real analysis of the file.
Well, they're doing some, you know.
I mean, so the analysis that they do is either emulation or dynamic runtime analysis.
Yeah.
Right? Let the file run and then, you know, watch it.
Watch as it does nothing while it waits for the sandbox to detonate.
absolutely, right? 5 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever.
Yeah, which is why I think that's got something to do with why FireEye's share price is kind of in the toilet. But anyway, do go on, John.
Poor FireEye. I feel bad for him. I really do. So essentially you end up with, I mean, from our perspective, you know, you end up with false positives where antivirus has essentially none. What we're looking for is, you know, the shared feature set that file has with either known good or known bad files. So normally what our false positives are self-baked files, right? Files that were created inside of an organization that nobody's ever seen before. And they don't necessarily, you know, they're not signed. They, you know, could use, you know, unsafe practices. They're doing whatever, right? It's a completely unique file.
Yeah, I mean, because most enterprise software actually does look like malware, right?
I mean, not all of it. I mean, so we're using Skype right now. Skype looks a lot like malware, right? When you actually analyze it, it's heavily packed. It's heavily obfuscated. You know, when it sets up communication channels outbound, it's all encrypted. For the most part, enterprise software is pretty homogenous, right? When we false positive on something, we never false positive on, you know, like Windows internals or anything that isn't a one-off, I guess is the best way to put it. And for years, and don't get me wrong, you know, both of our co-founders were from McAfee. Everyone took that, you know, false positives are the absolute worst thing you could do to an environment. And I get it from a stability perspective. If you're quarantined LSAS, right, like you're going to break your machine. However, how we've addressed it is by building a system that's really easy to deal with false positives.
Yeah, now this is kind of where I was going with that, right, is because other people have said, like I spoke to one of your customers and they said, yeah, look, when we first installed it, it threw up a bunch of false positives. Then we went click, 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 and we haven't had a problem since, right? So what's funny about that, right, is that this is used by the incumbent AV providers to sort of scream, oh, silence, false positives, all they do is detect packers, which, you know, isn't true. I know that's not true. But the thing is, you seem to have worked on the...
Yeah.
And honestly, man, most people I speak to, the reason that Cylance wins deals, it isn't for the better coverage. It's because it's really easy to manage. And the false positive thing kind of ties into that. Yeah, it throws up some alerts. You just go, yep, that's good, that's good, that's good. And then it shuts up and leaves you alone. And when someone builds something new and throws it on your network, it tells you and you can whitelist it. But that's kind of what you want. You would rather it throws up easy to manage false positives than false negatives that, you know, you just completely ignore, right?
That is exactly it. And what we've inherited via this old school mentality is a world of false negatives. I would rather have my security product be a bit overly paranoid than under paranoid. Because you are. I mean, I can have a customer deal with 50 false positives in, you know, the workflow to deal with that an hour and a half. The amount of work that goes into dealing with a false negative, a piece of malware that actually detonates inside of your environment and exfiltrates out data. I mean,
yeah, call in Mandiant. You know what I mean? Like, be prepared to shell out a few, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on the rebuild, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, you're looking at, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of professional services hours for someone to come in and be like, oh yeah, this was a commoditized piece of malware that or adware that got through.
Yeah.
And pose no real risk, but, you know, we had to do a full forensic investigation to prove that.
So where do you go from here, like, in terms of trying to figure out how to be appropriately benchmarked? I mean, what do you do? Do you reach out to the companies that do this type of testing and try to convince them to do it differently? I mean, have you even come up with a methodology that's better real-world testing that you could, you know, do better demos with? Or, I mean, it just seems like a tricky problem for you guys.
So we've tried and we've reached out to a bunch of the different, you know, standard AV testing agencies. And I've encountered a bunch of different responses, right? Everything from, I've tried to change the methodology of my test before and my customers have come back and told me not to do it. Right. Mm. To, you know, we're not interested. I mean, essentially AV testing is pay for play. Right. You write them a check for 50 grand, 100 grand a year. And, you know, you build this long-standing relationship with these testing houses, you know, that's worth millions of dollars. And so you have the ability to go through. They run a test. Right. And let's start with the fact that all of these major AV testing houses will go out and collect their own samples via websites. Right. They will then turn around and sell those samples to anyone. So you buy their subscription feed of samples, and every day they'll give you their new samples. And so if you simply take those files and blacklist them, right, or write a signature for them, you get 100%, right? And if you don't, when they're completed with testing, they come back to you and ask you if you want to challenge anything. So you get to go through this, you know, multi-week process of, oh, you tested a sample set of 100, you know, at initial test, you know, we got 85 of them. Let's figure out why to disqualify the other 15. And they'll do it because they're essentially a services business. Like, their whole revenue stream comes from companies like Cylance paying them to test our products.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that's the thing, man. If I'm an AV testing organization, I'm not exactly going to go, hey, I'm going to structure my tests to play to Cylance's strengths and piss off the other 8 legacy providers who give me 50 grand a year, right? Like, that's just not a good business decision for me.
Exactly.
And, you know, I can't be too hypocritical about this because this is a pay-to-play interview, for God's sakes. But, hey, that said, as I was saying to you earlier, I did recently actually turn down I didn't reply to a sponsorship request from a legacy AV provider. So I'm not that much of a hypocrite.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's always some hypocrisy in information security, but for the most part, people tend to be pretty transparent with their motives, right? If somebody gets on and starts making some grandiose claims, the nice thing about the information security community is, there are hundreds of people listening to this podcast that are smarter than you and I, and if we lie, can punch holes in our shit.
Yeah, well, that seems to be like it's the mantra. I've noticed that's the mantra with Cylance, is that's what everyone says. Go test it, play with it. Do you know what I mean? That's the putting your money where your mouth is. That seems to be the thing. It's like your number one marketing goal is to get people to try it.
I mean, that's it. That is our number one marketing goal, is to get people to actually try the product for themselves.
Yeah.
And it's from that perspective, it's really easy to show value, because you go to an enterprise where they're doing, you know, dozens of reimages every month. And it's really easy for them to see the value after a 30-day POC, when at the end of that 30 days, instead of reimaging 30 machines, they're reimaging one or two.
Yeah.
Right? It's not that our product is 100% effective. It's just better than traditional AV. You know, and what we're focusing on doing is essentially consolidating as many of the endpoint security products as we possibly can onto one agent, right?
Yeah, so, well, I'm going to be keeping I'm going to be paying very close attention to any acquisitions you guys make over the next 12 months or so, because I have a feeling that you guys will be expanding a little bit on the desktop and probably on the network as well, if I had to guess.
I will say this, and, you know, we've looked at numerous companies for acquisition over the last 6-8 months. We're very pensive to get into a situation that a McAfee or a Symantec has gotten into.
Bloat.
You end up with a product that, you know, you're not familiar with every single line of code in the product and what it actually does.
Yeah.
Right. So essentially you're buying a company for the marketing hype of that.
And for the customers and for the cross selling and all of that. But yeah, like, if you can't integrate it properly, there's not much point. But John, we're actually out of time, but John Miller, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about AV testing and all of that. It's been a pleasure, and I hope we can chat to you again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was John Miller from Silence there with a chat about the murky world of AV. And that is it for this week's show. Big thanks to Silence for sponsoring this week's program. They're on board next year as well as a sponsor, which is great. We've got 15 sponsors lined up for 2017. It's going to be a monster year. Really looking forward to that. But for now, that's all we got. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.